number 8, Lang versus J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. The panel in that matter will be myself, Justice Perrin, and Judge Hofstadt.
I'll be back.
Okay, counsel. I'm going to ask you an opening question before you even begin. And you can tell me the answer to the question, and you can also tell me if you think it's a relevant question, or it's a question that has no place here. And the question is, did your client, whatever you think is wrong with how this foreclosure went on, was carried on, did your client ever tender the money? And is that a relevant question? That's my two-part question.
Well, she did not offer to pay off the balance of the loan.
Okay.
She did meet every request that they made. She had made a loan that was $3,700 a month.
Yeah.
Within 2 years, it had jumped to more than $9,000.
Right.
And in that predicament, she simply couldn't raise that money.
No question about that.
So now, what about tender? The bank asked her to, when she asked for modification, the bank agreed if she would pay $700 a month.
Was it 700? I thought it was.
Maybe it was 62.
Whatever. I thought it was, all right, I can't remember, but anyway, go ahead.
It was about twice.
Yeah.
What she had originally started out paying. And they made an agreement with her, which maybe they, in fact, certainly they didn't have to do, but they made an agreement with her, and that's the trial plan agreement that is in the record.
Right.
And when you read that, you realize she complied with that contract. She stuck to it. She made the payments on time. She was never in breach. It said if all payments are made as scheduled, we will reevaluate your application. So that's as far as the contract goes.
Right, the 6,000, it was, I just, my colleague, yeah, pointed out it was 6,000 something.
6,000 something.
$384 yeah. To be exact, mm-hmm. I
right. Now this is on a property that's rental value is maybe 3,000, so she's yeah. really working to keep this together.
Yeah, no question about it.
And the agreement says that if any part of this agreement is breached, Washington Mutual has the option to terminate. It was never breached.
But wasn't the agreement by its term, sort of a three-month agreement that contemplated, it set out the three payments of the $6,400 for the, you know, the September, October, November of 2009. And at that point, that was sort of, she kept her into the bargain during those 3 months. She paid that amount. And during those 3 months, the bank didn't foreclose. By the time they foreclosed in July of the next year, the agreement had sort of run its course because those 3 months where they agreed to talk and not foreclose had long since expired. Why is that reading of the trial plan agreement wrong?
First, the allegations are clear that the bank never did talk to her. They just kept saying they lost the paperwork, and those facts are alleged. The agreement doesn't make it clear that it's for 3 months. You'll see that there is a payment of $6,384 for 10-1, mm-hmm. another one for 11-1, and then there's a blank for 12-1. And so it sort of has an open end to it, such that it's, I think, impossible for a trial judge to look at that and go, as a matter of law, there is no fact that needs to be determined here. Because every time I read this, I'm left with an open question. How long did this agreement really go? Did the bank ever keep up their part of the bargain? And that was to reevaluate her application. There's no proof of that. That's why we have a trial, so that we can find out what was going on inside the bank. It looks like what happened was they made this deal with her. They started taking the $6,300 a month. The 3 months went by. They still weren't communicating with her. So she kept paying and paying and paying until one day she finds out that her house is being sold. That's just not right. I can't see how we can stand and watch something like this happen and go, that's okay. You know, that's just the hard facts of foreclosure. If the bank had said that we will terminate this in 3 months, as they often do, that would be different. But they didn't clearly do that here. So you must read the trial plan agreement carefully in order to see whether or not in any way she breached it. Clearly they did. Or it's a fact that needs to be determined after discovery. But looks to me like they broke the agreement. They kept taking the money, and then they took the house. So I've tried to figure out what's the best way to approach this. One would be simply to go chronologically through all of the events, which actually date back to around 1999. But I think what I'd like to do is start at the end and work my way back.
All right, now, there were some findings, I think, or evidence in the record that the bank tried to contact her in July of 2010.
Yes, they made a call and her phone was not working, which was not true. We have no proof that that actually happened. And still, if you make a call and you don't have the phone, but the person has sent you a check for $6,300 that month, that should ring a bell. That's a lot of money. They received the check for that month, July. Then they made this allegation. This is the bank that had never talked to her, never evaluated. Then they make this allegation that they called somebody. We don't know who called. And they called some number, but we don't know what number they called because they don't say that. And they got a disconnect. We've all called numbers and got disconnect. What we usually do is redial and we get who we're trying to reach. But all they alleged was that we dialed at some number and there was a disconnect. And so we took her house. That's crazy. They kept they cashed the $6,300 check for July. Then they conducted the trustee sale. Then they sent her back the check. That's amazing. So I was going to suggest that I go backwards because something happened just recently, which I think is very relevant, and that's the Schuster case. It made clear that there were repeated issues in these cases where somebody basically tries to show that there's a technical defect of some sort, and now they want a free house. And that's been a common theme. I can't imagine how many.
We've been seeing a lot of these cases, obviously.
And that's, I think, a new theme, free house. I started wondering if I Googled it, how far back that goes. But the point is, how do we distinguish Susan Lang from the Schuster case, since that is the latest step that was taken in this field, and it was taken by this court. So how do we distinguish it? Susan made a good faith effort to resolve the issue after her payment tripled. Her payment tripled. And so she didn't just sit there and wait for the boom to fall.
Of course, her payment tripled because she agreed to that kind of a loan. I mean,
not really. She didn't know she was agreeing to that. Nobody would sign a contract like
that. No, but you don't know what the interest rate's going to be in the future. So, I mean, you're right. I mean, the point is, you know, you get a low interest rate and things change and interest rates go up, and I understand that. You never expect it to be that, but it could be that.
Right.
It did happen.
Well, the part of the question here is, at what point do you just go, this is ridiculous?
Yeah.
I mean, at what point do you say, whatever these banks were up to, it was nuts?
Yeah.
And in this case, what makes it so interesting is that the man, the actual human being who designed this system for WAMU, is part of this case. And that's Mr. Kaufman and his company, Alta. As alleged, he came up with a securitization system that he practiced until WAMU bought his company. Then they brought him in and put him in charge of designing the system that crashed all over Susan Lang's head. And so that makes this case very different than any other. It's not just about something technical and very complicated. It's about the person who designed the system and then came out here and bought one of the houses that crashed as a result of that system. So that gets us to the question of whether or not it makes sense to challenge the contract as void, and whether or not the purchasers at this unexpected sale that was not even apparently noticed anywhere, no notices were posted anywhere, whether the person who bought this house was in a position to call himself a bona fide purchaser, the mastermind of the securitization scheme. That raises an interesting question of fact. I don't see how Judge Burrell or anyone else sitting on the bench could straighten that one out just by ruling on a demur, and that's what happened here. It's fascinating. that these characters have come together. I don't know what got Mr. Kaufman out to Ojai from Washington Mutual's headquarters, but he bought the house. Did he know? I think that's a question that needs to be resolved by somebody who listens to the evidence.
If we agree with you, what's the remedy here? What happens?
Then you have a void sale. Then the presumption doesn't apply. So the sale can be undone.
What if you have a BFP?
We don't, though. We have Kaufman.
Okay.
But don't we have a subsequent sale when Alta and Seaside sold the house again? So do we have to undo both sales?
Well, I haven't figured that one out, actually. But what happens when somebody steals something and then they sell it to somebody else? And they say...
The rule is a thief passes no title, but we're not going to put that one in here, are we?
I'm sorry, what?
A thief passes no title is the rubric. You're suggesting that we would incorporate that into a commercial transaction?
And not just this case, but many cases. I don't think that this problem is going to get solved for a while, because I think we have an epidemic of defects in title. And as I understand it, if you take title and it's flawed and then you sell it to somebody else, that's too bad. The person who owns it gets it back. Or we come up with some other way of dealing with that problem. But yes, when somebody comes and buys a house knowing full well that this is, who is not a bona fide purchaser, let's keep it simple, and then they sell it to somebody else, that person doesn't get good title either, and neither will the person after that or the person after that. It could be 50 years from now when somebody comes back and litigates this all over again. As we know, in our country, real property issues do not go away, not for 100 years. And that's part of the strength of our system, frankly, is that we developed a real property law over centuries, which was based upon certain things being done, and that has only blown up in the last 10 years, and God help us if we even straighten it out in 50, because it wasn't how it was designed to work. So what about Schuster and what about Susan Lang? She made a good faith effort. I think that's really clear from the record. And she came up with the $6,000 a month, $6,300. And then after Kaufman and his company Alta came after her, she worked out through the court, through Judge Burrell, a $6,000 a month payment to stay the unlawful detainer action. And so she kept coming up with all this money to keep working on making this thing work. I think that is, by any definition, a good faith effort to distinguish from Schuster. She did not live there rent-free. She paid twice the value of the house to continue to be in her own house that she had lived in for so many years. She was misled. She was definitely misled. She signed an agreement with Chase, and she paid them month after month after month. How dare they take all of that money and then take her house? They could have said after 3 months, hey, the deal's off. You know, it was only 3 months, even though it's kind of hard to tell from the contract. But they didn't do that, so she was misled. And that distinguishes it also. They concealed the sale. As alleged, she would have come to the sale and made an offer, whether it involved friends helping to put up the money or whatever. There's no way she would have let them just sell that house out from under her. And that's in the alleged facts. So the sale was concealed from her. What is this that the trustee can notify and hold a sale of somebody's house and not even tell them? Not post it anywhere? And when I look at that, I begin to realize what seems to be lacking in all of these non-judicial foreclosures in California is due process. What's happening is so shocking, we can't help but step back and go, wait a minute, this is not who we are. We don't let this happen. Now, how do we get away from due process so far? It goes apparently back to the Garfinkel case in 1977, which said, non-judicial foreclosure is not state action. It's just something between the parties. And so there's no state action involved. The 14th Amendment does not apply. So how did 40 years go by and we're now in the situation where we have probably millions of foreclosures, which if we really look at them are shocking. I think what's changed is the idea that there is no state action involved in nonjudicial foreclosures. That may have been true in 77, but it's certainly not true now. Virtually every case that comes out talks about the comprehensive statutory procedure that must be followed, statutory. That's from the state. The state is so involved now in nonjudicial foreclosures, it's like a fortress that's been built. It's more like a tower off by itself, because California is drifting further and further away from the rest of the country in how we do foreclosures. An article published by Miller and Starr in their Real Estate News Alert this year, 50 pages long, I just stumbled upon it going through Google. And it's amazing. What Miller and Starr is saying, our respected treatise, is saying this now about California. First, it was discussing Gomez. It said, Gomez added insult to injury by refusing to permit the homeowner to amend its complaint to allege on information and belief. And then they go into how case after case requires that the homeowner plead facts that only the lender knows. And so in Gomez, the plaintiff said, well, let me allege it on information and belief. The court said no. So they go on to say this, a short paragraph. The case confronts the homeowner with the civil equivalent of a Star Chamber proceeding, Miller and Starr, this year. No right to identify or cross-examine the accusers or the alleged witnesses claiming the right to foreclose, and no ability to go behind the mere notifications and self-identifications of various other nominal players in the secondary market as agents for creditors who remain unknown and unseen. And it goes on from there. That's very strong language. Miller and Starr is shouting at us that we have created in this state a Star Chamber system. I remember about Star Chambers. I learned about them in law school. I never thought that I would be standing here saying that today. I better stop. I hope I have a little time.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, who's going to go first?
Good afternoon. Randall Cohen, Silver and Arsh for respondents, Alta Community Investment 3 LLC and Seaside Capital Fund 1 LP. We need to do a couple of things here. First, we need to make a clear distinction between the remedies that the appellant may have against the lender and the remedies that the appellant may have against the purchasers of the foreclosure sale. That's been sort of muddled, I think, in the conversations, and I think it's very important because while the appellant may have damage causes of action for some of the things that the lender did, that doesn't necessarily mean that the appellant has the right to get the property back. We also need to focus on the idea that lots of bad things may have happened. And we're constantly reading stories about what lenders are doing these days. And maybe Mr. Gillies is right. Maybe we need to have a wholesale rework of the foreclosure system. But that's not for this court to do. That's for the legislature to do. This court is not going to solve all of the due process problems of foreclosures in California with this case. What we need to do in this case is we need to look at whether the appellant established a cause of action that allowed her to get past the demurrers. And she didn't. She had four opportunities to do that, and she didn't. Now, the first issue that pertains to the purchasers at the foreclosure sale, this appeal is moot. All the cases say it's moot. There is no way that you can claw back the property from a bona fide purchaser after expungement of a list pendants. Now, the appellant talks about how, you know, how can we let this happen? How can these bad things happen and we're left without the remedy to get the property back?
Well, he could have a damage remedy, I suppose,
against
the lender. And I think he's even maybe indirectly, I don't want to put words in his mouth, maybe acknowledging that's a rough way to go. But he's focusing on what happened with the lender. He's also suggesting that the purchaser at the property doesn't have clean hands, so that gives him a handle there. But
well, and I understand that, and I acknowledge that. I think when I read the reply brief, for example, it looked to me like the focus was primarily on the lender and not on getting the property back. Whether the purchaser at the foreclosure sale was a bona fide purchaser for value or had unclean hands or anything else doesn't matter, because the trial courts made the determination that the plaintiff could not establish a cause of action and expunged the list pendants based on that conclusion. And once that list pendants is gone, our legislature has made the determination, and you look at the Mix case, which is a real good explanation of what the legislature did and why, because of the desire for the free transferability of the property.
But he does, presumably, I mean, if he could plead it properly, if the trial court made an error, depending upon what we decide, have a damage cause of action.
Of course.
Yeah.
The only damage causes of action against the purchasers at the foreclosure sale really were the 13th and 14th causes of action for respondeat superior and for negligence. All of the other causes of action involved an attempt to get the property back or relied on having title to that property. So all of those other causes of action against the purchasers, against Alta and Seaside, have to be moot because this court can't do anything to give them that remedy. So he's left with his damage claims against the lender, and I'll let the lender argue those.
Let him do so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the lender. Counsel for the lender.
Good afternoon. Mariel Geralt on behalf of JPMorgan Chase Bank. I will try not to repeat anything that counsel for the buyers has stated, Your Honors. I would like to echo one thing, however. I think that one of the key issues that we need to address from the briefings is the issue of what is the burden and what is the court looking at. The appellant's opening brief and reply brief has a lot of language and argument alluding to a standard that would be more proper for an MSJ, putting the facts before the jury and things of that nature, as well as making argument that there are some sort of onus on the defendants during a demur to set forth facts or make argument or provide evidence that would somehow establish that they did not do certain things. And what we're really looking at is the fact that the appellant failed to meet her burden to plead the causes of action, the various elements of the causes of action, and also that Judge Burrell did not abuse his discretion with the totality of what had happened in denying leave to amend, especially given the fact that when we look at the opposition and the argument made by the appellant, that they failed to establish how further amendment would be able to cure the deficiencies. And I certainly won't go through all the specific issues with the 13 various causes of action, but I did want to focus on a couple of arguments that were raised. I believe in the reply, appellant, for the first time, made an argument related to a potential promissory estoppel claim. And I think that Judge Burrell pretty clearly evaluated that potentiality in his ruling. And I think that it speaks volumes that he specifically laid out language from the trial plan agreement stating that this was a conditional agreement. He quoted it stating, and then stated to the extent the plaintiff alleges the moving defendant encouraged her to believe she would receive a loan modification. Reliance upon such a belief would be unreasonable in light of the express terms of the trial plan agreement to the contrary. And I think that that specific language was evaluated by Judge Burrell. I think it also is very clear in the record that there was no promise that was made in this regard. And I don't think that there is anything that appellant has brought forth to demonstrate that they satisfied the requirements to set forth a cause of action on any of the claims that they have alleged. I also, would like to just very quickly address, appellant also made some reference to, again, the issue of who was the quote-unquote owner of the loan. And we have facts that the plaintiff herself alleged that and conceded that J.P. Morgan Chase assumed the rights to this loan through the FDIC as a receiver when it took over Washington Mutual Bank. And that was in her amended pleadings and in the record at pages 622 to 623. So I don't really think we have that particular issue here, despite the argument to the contrary and sort of ignoring the actual record and allegations that were made. If the court has no further questions.
I don't think so. No. Thank you. So you know what this comes down to, what counsel are saying, it's a pleading question, it's a pleading problem, and that their respondents are arguing that you haven't pled facts that give rise to a cause of action. I understand you disagree with that, but that's what they're focusing their argument on.
Right, and as you, I'm sure, noticed, I spent most of my time in the opening brief pleading the facts.
Yes.
Knowing that you do know the law, and that if the facts raise a claim, even if it wasn't technically pled, that still entitles this case to go back.
Yeah.
And that Judge Burrell was making some factual findings. I think if you read that trial plan agreement, you will sharply disagree with his conclusion. He tried the case in a demur.
Yeah.
And this trial plan agreement is not all that clear. It looks like it was written in a Starbucks, and it left out a lot. Now, the banks write very long, complicated contracts. I don't know where this one came from, but it didn't make it at all clear whether or not they were entitled to do what they did. Another matter, which is very interesting, and that's that they substituted the trustee.
Happens in all these cases. We're getting that argument has been presented in numerous cases.
Right, and yet, how do we get past this? Let's say, all right, so what happened here was that they filed a notice of default, and then 10 days later, somebody signed an assignment that made the trustee the trustee. So when they actually recorded the notice of default, they were just one of 6 billion people. They had no authority whatsoever. How do you go forward from that and have a legitimate foreclosure? You can go back and start over with a new notice of default, but they never did. And they never do. They always stick with the original notice of default. So when she made that, when she did that, signed that notice of default and filed it, she had no authority whatsoever. It was the wrong trustee. Suppose that I were to sit down and start drafting executive orders, because someday I hope I'll be the mayor of my town. And then ultimately somehow I get elected and I come along and say, now all of those orders have been in effect all this time because eventually I did become the mayor. So you guys weren't following my orders. That's what this is like. The person is not anything, and then they file the papers, and then a couple weeks later they become authorized to do it. How can that possibly be valid? That's different.
Maybe you can point me to my understanding is that the substitution was signed on a particular date but wasn't notarized until another date. And there's a statute out there that says that as long as the substitution is executed at or before the time of the notice of default, it's valid. Do you have any authority for the proposition that executed means signed and notarized rather than just signed? Because if it just means signed, I think that statute allows what they did.
Yes, but how do we know it was signed? That's a fact.
Well, we have a contract that has a signature and a date next to it.
Yeah, but the contract was notarized in Minnesota by a Minnesota notary, and if we were to get into the facts, we would discover the person who was doing the assignment, whose name was on there, was also in Minnesota. So, and the allegations are that this was not signed until 10 days after the notice of default. So how does a court ruling on a demur make that factual finding when it's so improbable? Why would somebody sign something in Minnesota working for a $2.4 trillion corporation and then wait 10 days to get somebody down the hall to notarize it? Maybe that's what happened, but I think we're entitled to check. That's a fact.
Okay.
If I could respond just very briefly to that last point, there's a new case that isn't in the briefs, but I think we've all seen the briefs. Wilson versus Hynek, June 2012, 207 Cal App 499, allows an agent of the beneficiary to sign a notice of default, does not require the trustee sign it. So that has resolved the entire issue.
We'll take a look at the case.
Yeah. As I said, you know the law.
Thank you.
We do? Okay, I hope we do. Everyone thinks we know the law. You help us with the law. That's what lawyers do, believe it or not.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The matter is under submission.